Okay, so I guess we might as well get going. So some of you have had labs already on Monday, right? And then some of you have it today. How about the Monday group? How was it? Not so bad, right?
Yes.
But it did take pretty much the whole time, right, I think, for the group. It depends on how large your sections are and stuff. And we'll go around and try to help you so we're in the labs to make sure we get through this content. But it relates really well with what you're doing this week in lecture, right? So it goes hand in hand. All right, so let's go over a little bit of stuff. Just to make sure, let's see, is it break time? Yes, it should be recording now. So on your syllabus, just to make sure we're clear about the dates on what's happening, let's cruise on down here. To the schedule, the lab schedule, because maybe it's a little confusing the way I have it on the web page with that. So we go all the way down to the bottom of the syllabus, and you see, so what is today? Today is the 29th, right? 29th. Is it the 29th or 28th? How come that? It's 29th, right? Yeah, we're on a time warp. Okay, so labs, what you're doing this week, resting membrane potential lab, right? And then the next week you're doing this frog lab. And then the following week is the exam week, right? Yes, exam week. Remember that? Okay. But the other sections, they don't want to have exams, they don't want to have lab during that week. But for your benefit, what we're going to do is have labs, but we're going to do some fun activities. But it's your time for answering any questions, going over old exams, whatever you want to do in a smaller group of, you know, 20 students per lab. Probably won't take the full time, but it gives you a smaller group to kind of work through any problems. So think this lecture, this section, we have four sections of labs, so I'm going to be in there all four sections, right, to help as smaller groups so we can work through any problems that you have. So go through the test bank, go through any questions you have. Supposedly in a smaller group, people will come out of their shells and talk more and say, hey, I don't understand that, and we can go through that content, okay? So, exam week on that Thursday, right, we have an exam on that Thursday. That week, if you have a lab on Monday, or you have a lab on Tuesday, or you have a lab on Wednesday, for our sections 1 through 4, we will spend that time going over old exams, reviewing for the test, stuff like that. Plus some fun activity in the lab that goes relatively quick, right? So there's no TAs there. It's not required that you're there because we're not going to take roll. It's up to you all if you want to go there. And there's no echo recordings in the lab. So if you want to go to the labs that week, we do some hands-on activities, which you might find as open response questions later, or you can get with your partners or whatever. I don't care if you switch around labs and you go to a different lab that week, because I'm not taking a roll, okay? So it's the Monday labs. You know which labs are ours, right? It's on the front of your web page. So these times, wherever they are, these right here, right? Monday's lab 3 to 5 or 3 to 6. Tuesday lab 12 to 3. Wednesday lab 9 to 12 and 12 to 3. That's our labs for our class. So you can go to any of those labs. They're all going to be the same content. Right? Okay? Are we all good? All right? So whatever works your schedule. And then we have that test on that Thursday. Okay? And the following week, I hate missing labs because I think labs are actually more important than lecture because you do things, right? And you actually learn things by doing it. You can always read books, Khan Academy and all that stuff. Don't have to hear me yapping. So that lab of the week afterwards, what we're going to do is to go over the exam in the lab. And we're having the class test or exam in class, right? And there's going to be different versions. So what are we going to do over in the lab? We're going to go over those questions that you have and make sure everybody understands the content. Because what we want you to understand is to make sure if you missed anything on the exam, did I screw it up? Did I key the wrong answer, for example? Or did I make the question too confusing? Are there two answers that might be really good? I didn't make up the lab quizzes, just so you know. Okay. But the electric test will make that up. And maybe you say, oh, I read in this book, this made more sense to me. Well, okay, let's discuss it, and then we correct the, you know, whatever might be, misunderstanding. So that's the purpose of the labs a week afterwards. Okay, so we go over the exam, make sure you all get, you know, 100%, you understand all the content, anything you missed in the exams, and then we move on to the next subjects. But we'll probably do some content in those labs the following week after the exam as well, right? We can, you know, give you a little more content about some aspects that we might be covering. Okay, are we good? Yes? No? Okay, you're awake. All right, good. All right, so that's what's happening. So don't get confused with, you know, what we have up here. We say review for the exam. So the week of the exam that we're having, we're going to be, where is that thing? Yeah, the week of the exam, somewhere there's an exam on here. Where did it go? There it is. Where's the exam? Oh, here it is. On that Thursday, we are meeting that week of the exam. We're going to do some hands-on activities. We're going to have some review. And then the next week, we review the exam that you've already taken. Okay? So that's what's happening there. Clear? Yes? Okay, good. Okay, so make sure you schedule that out for you. Don't get confused with the other section. If you're looking at the other section or your friend's notes that might be another class that meets on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, they don't meet those lab days, but they're not having as much review for the exam. Okay? So pros and cons to it all. All right. Where are we? We are here. Are we here? Yes? Remember where we are? Okay. And what did we talk about with this? Just to remind you, you know, leak permeability through leak channels in the membrane, this can be a little confusing sometimes in the text, so I'm rehashing that. Leak channels through the membrane, it's a channel that allows sodium, potassium to kind of go through, mostly potassium, but can be a little bit leaky to sodium as well, especially if potassium outside is low. And that's what we'll talk about a little bit more. Okay, and we mentioned about the refractory period, right, of neurons. What's the main take-home of refractory period? Why is it we can't stimulate a second stimulus in an axon really quickly? Well, it's the main take-home that you have to remember about that.
Everything has to reset.
There has to be a reset. What kind of reset are we talking about?
The voltage-gated sodium channels are still
activated. Yes, they're still inactivated. And so they have to remove, what the key word is, removal of inactivation. It's usually not in your textbook explained exactly that way, but removal of inactivation. So by having some time back at rest, it allows that protein, remember it's a protein made up of amino acids, it allows it to come back to a conformational change, which it can then reopen again. So as we're going on the upstroke, right here, what is this? It's a greater response than what happens right here at that little deflection threshold for voltage-gated sodium channels, right? Boom. They open up. Sodium rushes in. The driving gradient is to go to E-sodium, but it doesn't quite go to E-sodium. The potential, why? What are some of the factors that we have to think about? A couple factors. One, there's less driving gradient as you get closer to E-sodium, right? And then what else happens? What happens? Probably around here somewhere. Voltage-gated potassium channels are opening, right? And that's counteracting the sodium that's coming in. But what else is happening around here? As the sodium voltage-gated sodium channel opens, what does it do? Goes into an inactive state, right? So the more you're opening, the more those are closing. They're going into an inactive state. So you're opening them, but they're going into an inactive state, and the voltage-gated potassium channels are opening. So you're not going to go to the E-sodium, okay? And now the voltage-gated sodium channels are inactivated and the voltage-gated potassium channels are open and they don't show that inactivation, so you're going now towards E-potassium, so you're coming back down, right? And in this case, think about if this was an intracellular recording different from the other figure in your textbook, and this is where people get confused sometimes. You don't see an afterpolarization, after hyperpolarization. Well, why is the other figure show that and this one doesn't? It depends on the cell, right? But you could make a prediction here. Where is E potassium? Where would you estimate E potassium to be in this figure? Close to the resting membrane potential, right? Because it just came right back to resting membrane potential. So this case, if this was an intracellular recording, you have to get this in your mind, if this was an intracellular recording, then it didn't come, it didn't show that after hyperpolarization. It would only show that if really E potassium was down here. So E potassium, if this is intracellular, probably right after resting membrane potential, it just comes right back to resting membrane potential. Let's go back just to rehash that. You see it here, and this is why it's confusing sometimes to people. You see this one, that went below the resting membrane potential. So E potassium is probably right here, right? It's going towards E potassium. But why doesn't it stay down at E potassium? Why is it not staying at that more negative value?
The sodium potassium pump brings it back to the resting membrane potential.
One of the factors, so two things we should think about. One is the voltage gate, the sodium potassium ATPase dependent pump is actually pumping to get that reset, but are the channels still open? What opened the voltage gated potassium channels? The depolarization, right? Well, are we depolarized anymore? No. So they are going to start to close. It's not inactivation, they just close. They don't show that inactivation. So in this case, you could look back here and yes, it's going to drive it towards E potassium, but now those are going to start to close anyways because they're not open. The threshold for opening up the voltage-gated potassium channels is up here, right? So there's no potential across there to keep those open, so they're going to start to close. Now, in your textbooks, in the way they explain the, even the other figure that you have and the other figures that we're going to see later on, here, for example, you know, in what we just went through about opening up voltage-gated potassium channels, it's generally, you think about putting that all kind of as one voltage-gated potassium channel, but in the squid axon, for the shape of the action potential, you don't have to go into the details for here, but I want you to understand that actually it's not just one type of voltage-gated potassium channel. They now know there's like five different types of voltage-gated potassium channels in the squid axon. Some open up quickly and they close. Some open up with a delay and they close slowly. And there's all different types. So in general, though, that gives the shape of the action potential that we talk about. And in most textbooks, they kind of just explain it as one voltage-gated potassium channel. But really, it's a mix of those, okay? We don't have to know all the nitty-gritty details, but in case you hear that, I don't want you to say, well, no, it's only one. And in the standardized exams, they don't go through different types of voltage-gated potassium channels, but usually the action potential is made up of multiple types. Okay? Just that you've heard that, and it's not you're not caught off guard sometime down the line like, I never heard that before. Okay, so if we spend some time at rest, we remove the voltage-gated inactivation of the inactivation of the voltage-gated sodium channel, and when we stimulate the nerve again, we can get a full-blown action potential. So this time, smaller ones, and in here we can't get anything. Even if we gave a stronger stimulus, you can't get a second one because the voltage-gated sodium channels are inactive. So you can actually think about this. What limits how fast you can receive a sensory information? If you touched your skin, you had, you know, how fast can you receive that information? Whoa. Well, if they're inactive for a certain amount of time, you can't keep up with it, right? So that could limit how fast you perceive information, too, right? The voltage-gated sodium channel inactivation. So that's kind of neat. And maybe it's different in different animals. Maybe it's different at different temperatures for different animals, right? Because it's a protein that has to have a conformational change. So kind of interesting. And actually, people study some of that, but it's not completely described. You could actually use your crayfish preparations, and wouldn't that be a fun experiment? Have it at different temperatures and test the absolute refractory period. And you could have different times. On the frog, sciatic nerve that you're going to have in that dish, exactly depending on what the experiment is, you could actually do this at different temperatures. If we're going to talk about the frog sciatic nerve, which is sometimes confusing compared to what we just went over, because the frog's sciatic nerve is made up of multiple axons, right? Multiple neurons. And we're going to see a compound action potential versus a single action potential from a nerve. Okay, so what would be the purpose of having, do you think, a refractory period of the voltage-gated sodium channels? What might be a rationale that we could think of if you were, you know, this happens, and now you're going to say, why on earth would we need that? What's maybe the benefit of it? You know, you kind of think of physiological mechanisms in us usually try to benefit us, right? Sometimes they go amok and they harm us, but generally, why would you think this would be useful in the nervous system? Anybody?
Send the signal one way.
I was hoping I get to pull a hat.
Yes.
Send the signal.
Send the signal one
way. Yes, so it's going to go. Yeah, that's a perfect example here, is that so it will go one direction. So when it's initiated, like the dendrites, soma, you know, axon hillock, let's say this is the motor neuron, that initiate it, and it goes down this direction, right? And when it gets down to the nerve terminal and releases transmitter, what prevents it from going back up, right, and colliding with another response? So basically, if it goes down to the nerve terminal, it won't come back up, right? And it allows it, it won't have a collision with another action potential coming down. So it pretty much keeps it going one direction. Now, if we take an electrode and we stimulate in the middle of your arm here, and there's an axon going across there, either sensory going up to your spinal cord, or a motor neuron going down, and we stimulate in the middle of that axon, which way does the action potential go? Trick? Question? No. What did we cover? Let's say we're just stimulating right there in the middle now. What do you think might happen? And why is this important? It could go either direction, right? If it's going to go both directions, it's going to go down to the nerve terminal. Let's say it's a motor neuron, and it's going to cause your fingers to twitch, right? But it's also going to go, what? Right back up. Why wouldn't it? You've only stimulated it right here. There's no refractory period this direction. So now you stimulated it back up the axon, back past the axon hillock, into the soma, into the dendrites, right? What about the sensory neuron? Well, the sensory neuron's going to go, and you're going to feel it like, oh, something's touching my fingertips, right? Because I'm stimulating in the middle. It doesn't know that it didn't start out here. And the action potential's going to go where it would normally go. And you're going to say, oh, somebody's touching my fingertips. But they're not touching your fingertips. They're stimulating in the middle of your arm. But what's going to happen this direction? So it's going to shoot down that direction, down to the sensory endings, where you have stretch-activated ion channels, but you don't have any perception, right? And it's going to have that refractory period, so it's not going to come back down. So it doesn't really matter that it goes that way, right? Right? So it's because it doesn't go to your brain, you're not going to have a cognitive response. But what about that other situation, where we were stimulating a motor neuron in the middle, causes your fingers to twitch, and it goes that direction. Now, why is that important, do you think? To think about that. Anybody ever see anybody with a little pack they might have on their belt, and they're actually getting electrical pulses, or they might have had an injury, for example, maybe they cut their nerve, and what they're trying to do is to keep that nerve healthy to regenerate. And your motor neurons and your peripheral nerves grow about a millimeter a day. So if you have a cut, right, the idea is to keep that nerve. That cut is closer to the cell body, more likely the cell will die, the neuron will die. The farther it is away from the cell body, the more likely it will survive and continue to grow. So your peripheral nervous system grows about a millimeter a day. That's pretty cool, right? The problem is, what if you cut that nerve? How do you get it to get back to your big toe, right? So what they try to do is to match up if that nerve got cut. Just kind of keep the two nerve endings together. It doesn't really fuse right there, but it's really interesting because it will follow the track. Now you just kind of have to make sure it gets to the right spot and doesn't go to the wrong muscle, right? That's what people are trying to work out. So it's really cool. Some people have where they might have a crush on their face right here. There's a nerve that goes, it's a trigeminal, and if you mix it up, like a crush, and then it regenerates. Sometimes the trigeminal grows the wrong direction, but it still finds the shaft of the old nerve because it's wrapped around with myelin, and it will start to grow to the wrong spot. So when you're eating, for example, and you're supposed to salivate, you actually are crying because it goes to your lacrimal glands. And when you're sad, you start to salivate. Isn't that wild? So they know that the nerve, you know, it got damaged and it's regrowing, it's going to the wrong target cells. So your nerves regenerate about a millimeter a day. Now they know that actually stimulating them will help them. So people put on little backpacks and they stimulate the nerve somewhere higher up to help it to grow. That's kind of neat, but guess what? These packs, and you can talk to a neurologist if anybody knows anybody, or a neurosurgeon, and ask them about it. See what they say. It's kind of interesting because it's still debated in the literature, and there's some neat experiments that could actually help address this. Where if you stimulate that motor neuron and you're shooting an action potential up into the cell body and into the dendritic tree, does the dendritic tree normally see action potentials? Right? Because the action potential initiates and goes this way. It's not going to go back up over the soma. It's not going to go that because of the refractory period, right? It's not going that direction normally. And so that's a region that's not normally seeing these large potentials. And what does it do to the calcium load inside of the dendritic tree or the cell body? It could alter that beyond its natural process and actually cause more damage than good. If you put too much calcium inside of the neurons, they can actually damage those. It starts apoptosis, cell-regulated cell death. We'll get into the nervous system a little bit later, but while we got on that regeneration, it's just so beautiful. There's a guy, Albert Aguayo. He was originally from Argentina. He works up at McGill University, or Montreal General Hospital in Canada. He should get a Nobel Prize. He's just phenomenal. He has neurosurgeons working with him. He has computational biologists working with them, and they do these surgeries on rodents, and some of it they're trying to get it going on to humans, but it's phenomenal what this guy's doing. So what he does is he takes, takes the optic nerve in rodents, cuts that optic nerve, and what happens? That optic nerve, the cell bodies are in the back of your retina, and seeing if they can grow, regenerate, and go back. So what's the problem? Why can't they regenerate really well? How can they get back to the right spot? So what he does is he takes that rodent model and he'll take the sciatic nerve out of the, right? The neurons die, but the myelin wrapping stays there. And he can take that and put that in the back of the retina and then take that kind of that matrix and put it around over the brain and then put it in the right spot in the brain like the optic tectum. And those neurons will grow and follow that path and then go into the optic tectum. And you can actually then give light pulses and show that the optic tectum is actually firing, that it made the connections. But how to make the right connections, that's what they're trying to work on. But it's really cool that these nerve grafts give the matrix and the stimulation for the nerve to grow. Isn't that cool? That's really cool. So there's a lot of neat things about that, aspects with stimulation, the right activity, the right profile for ion movements, but also not damaging the cells. So how much stimulation should one give to those motor neurons without damaging them? Something interesting to think about, right? And you could address those kind of experiments, right? Maybe how would you design an experiment to test that? And we could think about that as a, you know, something as a class. Okay, so just think about why different neurons have different kinds of activity profiles. Some neurons, if you stimulate them, it's a single cell. You give a current injection, and you get the threshold, and boom, you get an action potential. But maybe some other neurons you stimulate, and you might get something different. Maybe you get a series of action potentials. Why might you have differences in different cell types? Why would this neuron give you multiple spikes, and another neuron, you give it one time, and it only gave you one, and it didn't fire again? Why do you have different shape action potentials in different neurons? Some of them are big, some of them are wide. What gives rise to those? Well, someone else.
Different speeds of refractory periods, the different proportions of numbers of gates and weak channels.
Exactly. And the term that, in case you didn't hear, that the density and the types of ion channels that are in the membrane. Maybe this one cell has a lot of voltage-gated potassium channels. And I just told you that every cell usually has various types of voltage-gated potassium channels. So maybe there's a different distribution of the voltage-gated potassium channels in the one neuron compared to the other. Maybe there's more, and it keeps it, you know, at a lower state for a longer period of time. Maybe there's not as many. Maybe one has more calcium channels, and it keeps it depolarized longer. Remember the nerve terminal, presynaptic nerve terminal, the $100 bet? What's the shape of the action potential in the nerve terminal? It's probably a little bit wider than in the axon because you have voltage-gated calcium channels, right? So that could change the shape of the action potential. Maybe there, you know, some other factors involved. So not every neuron is going to have the same profile. So if you look at a single action potential, and this one then has a half after hyperpolarization. Some textbooks just call this hyperpolarization afterwards, but this one says after hyperpolarization. So you know the EK is below, is lower than the resting membrane potential. Don't get confused when you look at textbooks with this. And this is confusing sometimes, that's why I bring it up. This G is conductance of the ion. Now, sodium's going into the cell, okay? But it just shows you that the conductance goes along with the upstroke of the action potential, and then it dampens. And it shows you that the potassium conductance, it's going out of the cell, is it starts a little bit later. And this is where the threshold probably is for opening up a lot of the voltage-gated potassium channels. And then it's slow to close, right? Slow to close. And that's why we kind of have that long after hyperpolarization. Of course, the sodium-potassium pump is working madly at the same time, okay? And a lot of this great work happened in the 1950s using the squid axon in labs in England and in Italy, marine biology labs, where they could take out this large axon, as we mentioned before, and they could put electrodes inside of it. They could change the bath on the inside or the outside, and they were really lucky, like serendipity, that the extracellular solution that they were using was just seawater, because the squid extracellular solution in their body is pretty close to seawater. So they were able to get these shapes of these action potentials. Pretty cool. If you lower the sodium outside, you can look at the action potential shape, drops, drops, drops. And if you put it back, it can pretty much get it back to the normal amplitude. Okay, so this gets a little confusing sometimes, and I just wanted to go over this, and I figured out how to get this to record on Echo. And we have a new projector here, too, so we got to see what we got here. Okay, let's see if this works. So it should be recording on Echo. So what's going on with these next experiments? I just want you to kind of get an idea, and we're not going to go through these. You don't do this in the lab. It's a little bit too involved. But if you took a cell, and a lot of times what has been used, and a guy named Ricardo Malaiti from, he was originally from Lebanon, and then he went to Mexico City, and now he was at San Diego. But he actually, he should get a Nobel Prize for this. It's really cool. He actually used the frog oocyte, the egg, and he could inject messenger RNA in that egg and have proteins expressed. Or he could inject the DNA into the nucleus and have it inside of the nucleus where it would then make the messenger RNA and then make the protein. So he did this in different techniques, but it's a beautiful model that he had, and I'm surprised he didn't get a Nobel Prize yet, but he should because so much work has come out of this. So frog oocyte is large, and it can do a lot of neat experiments, and you can express channels that normally are not expressed in the frog oocyte. So generally, let's say this is a cell. And now with the technology that people have, you can do these in normal cells as well. But a lot of the work came from using the frog oocyte. Let's just say this is a neuron taken out of a rat brain, for example. You put an electrode in, you put another electrode in, and at one of these you can inject current, R, and then you can measure voltage in the other one. Okay, maybe you get something like that. R, you know, you could do other things. You can actually, so this could be voltage, this could be current. You can do another techniques. You could actually say instead, like I went over with the IV curves, you could hold the voltage at a particular potential, and you could measure what current flows, right? Is it an inward current? Is it an outward current? And so if this is current, downward is always inward, and upward is always outward. Is this being recorded? Yes. Okay. Outward. And so you can do these kind of experiments. So you could voltage clamp, and you can measure the currents. You can voltage clamp at different voltages, more higher voltage, lower voltage, all these different voltages, and you can measure currents. Okay. So that's what's done basically in these type of experiments. Now, what's going on here is a little confusing sometimes. Let's look at this middle trace there in that figure. Now, how do I go back to this thing? Okay, right here. Let's look at this middle trace. You give this current, you hold this voltage at a certain value, and then you look at the current. And first you get this inward current, and then it's followed by an outward current. Well, that's kind of that's what's happening when you initiate an action potential in that preparation, because that's what we just went over with these, right? Conductance of sodium and potassium. Okay, so this is why this is sometimes confusing. But if we then used a blocker, let's use TTX, a voltage-gated sodium channel blocker. Okay, so we use a blocker, and we block the sodium channels, the voltage-gated sodium channels that can't open. Remember what this TTX is? The puffer fish, right? We talked about that. You know, the Japanese puffer fish. They cut it up. They eat it. They get the little tingling in their mouth, right? Hopefully they don't die from it. And then, but they found out that that blocks voltage-gated sodium channels. So it's been used a lot in experimentation. So if we block the inward current that's opening up from voltage-gated sodium channels, what do we have left? This outward current, the potassium current, right? Because we blocked all the voltage-gated sodium channels. So what do you see here? You see this line right here, this purple line. Well, that's just the potassium current then. If we took the potassium current, we subtracted it from the total current, what do we get? There's the sodium current. Isn't that nice? Beautiful experiments. And that's how they determined these different currents. They could use blockers. Now you could do just the opposite. You could actually use a potassium channel blocker, and you could block this potassium outward, and you would then just have this current, right? So you could test it both ways. And this is what people have done historically. So it's really nice that you can understand these currents by using blockers to these particular voltage-gated channels and understand what's going on. Okay, so why do we bring this up? It's so beautiful because this is what science, they love to do, right? Is to try things multiple ways, work it to death, right? Job security. No, you do lots of different experiments to try to figure out, is this holding true? And you try different designs of experiments in different ways to find out, is this all working right? And so what we've talked about, you know, equilibrium potentials, right? IV curves, using blockers, using all these different techniques, voltage clamping, measuring the currents, all those kind of things that we've talked about. Think of all the different experiments used to basically substantiate what you now know, that there's a voltage-gated sodium channel, there's voltage-gated potassium channels, causes the upstroke, the inactivate, the come back down. Wow. I mean, all these different experiments collected together support that rationale, right? So it's really amazing when you think about all the work that's gone on with the squid and different preparations to then substantiate what we know. Okay. So the shape of the action potential, you know, the upstroke and the downstroke, Bernard Katz worked out that. When you hear Bernard Katz, you just, you know, put your hands together again and hum, right? Hum. Okay. Because Bernard Katz is just one of those gods. He did so many things to help us understand physiology. So Bernard Katz was working out the shape of the action potential. Remember the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation, right? Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation. He worked out the shape of that action potential using the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation. And he did that by looking at the permeability of these ions and working out, he used differential equations, right? Oh, everybody's purging themselves right now, right? Differential equations, this is why you have calculus, but we don't use it, you know, in your curriculum anymore, it's just brain activities for you. But he used differential equations initially to work out the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation. He didn't have that, he derived, right? And that's what you have today. So he worked out the upstroke of the action potential by using differential equations for the different permeability of ions, and it took him a year to work out the upstroke, right? And when he was interviewed about how much longer will it take you to work out the downward stroke and to understand what's going on with permeabilities and ions, And he said he had some mathematical shortcuts, and he thinks it's only going to take another 6 months. Think of those labs. We can have lab exercises, doing differential equations, working out probability. No, okay. See how lucky we are that he did all that? Okay, so that's the idea of the shape of the action potential. We worked it to death. You should know it really well by now, right? Right? Everybody got it down? Okay, so some other techniques that are really good to understand. So we're talking about when we're doing all those techniques, the whole cell or the whole axon. And now we have to understand the next part. What gives rise to those potentials? Those ion channels that we've been talking about. But let's get down to the level of a single channel and understand how the channel works. And that's this next technique called patch clamp technique. And Sockman and Nair, the German group that works at Max Planck, Nair used to work up at Washington University, went back to Germany, but they described this technique and they got the Nobel Prize for this. And it's kind of odd, a Nobel Prize for the technique. But it's so powerful that people use it all over the world to understand how single channels work. So a patch clamp like this, they take a electrode, glass electrode, put it over the membrane, make a little vacuum, and they can pull the membrane and make a very tight seal across here. Now, they can give a current across here and open up a channel, right? Just like normally opening up a channel. And they can see, how does this single channel work? Now, maybe they have two channels. Maybe they have one. They can also take that patch of membrane off. This is called patch clamping that they can do. They can take that patch off and put it into a bath and make that bath like the intracellular solution, right? Or they can do different techniques. They can perfuse this electrode with a neurotransmitter, for example, like acetylcholine, and they can maybe have the acetylcholine receptor in here and find out what kind of currents go through acetylcholine receptors at your on your muscle fiber, for example, right? So this is a really powerful technique because this allows them to understand how single channels work. Let's look at this example here for a part. You give this current step, and then all of a sudden, or you give this voltage step, sorry, and you hold the voltage open, so you open up voltage-gated sodium channels, and you've given it for some time. And then you repeat that over and over again, maybe 100 times. So one time, two times, three times. And you got these different traces. And you keep doing this 100 times. And you average all the blue traces here. If you average all the blue traces, you get something like that. That's kind of neat. Some channels opened right away. Some channels stayed open maybe a little bit longer. Some kind of fluttered. Maybe, you know, took a little time to close. Isn't that kind of neat? Now, I'm going to go back. That's the current for the whole cell with an electrode put in there, measuring all the channels. So what's the take home of this? The single channel recordings mimic basically like all the channels functioning, right? So you can understand how single channels work repetitively. It's a statistical, you know, average. And it pretty much mimics what the whole cell responds when you activate all the channels, those voltage-gated channels. So this technique was very powerful in understanding what you get when you're looking at the whole cell. And you can understand opening times, how much current is actually coming through that channel when it's open. And this is very important because ion channel pathologies. Remember that PDF I sent you all? They now do this with mutated channels to understand. Calcium, night blindness is a voltage-gated calcium channel that's gone amok. Other ion channel pathologies that you could look through on that PDF I sent you, they can actually understand how that channel, what's wrong with that channel. And so they can understand the mechanism of the current mess-ups, for example. And people actually make artificial membranes like this. And there's a group in Chile that's world famous for this, actually. And they can put proteins in here, ion channels that they've made, high expression, and put them in there and actually see how they work across, say, a setup like this. So that's pretty cool. If you see something like this, you can see how many channels do you think are here. Let's say these are, maybe a type of potassium channel, although it's different. Or maybe it's a sodium channel that didn't show inactivation. And you had a patch clamp, and you wanted to see how many channels are in your patch of electrode, right? How many ion channels are in that patch? Well, let's see what happens when we start to open those. Well, we get unitary current here. So here's like one channel opened. Whoa, this one went down a whole step. So here's like one channel, here's another channel. And here, by chance, we had a third channel that just opened. and then back to 2, and back to 1, and then it closed. And here, so you go to the highest level of the unitary changes, and you could say that there are most likely 3 channels in that patch of membrane, right? Because it opened up at least 3 steps. 1, 2, where was the other one? Did I go 3? Yeah, 1, 2, and 3, right? So sometimes on exams you're going to see something like that, maybe, and people counted all throughout there and thinking that that was the total number of channels. That's not what we're looking at here. It's the unitary increase, right, or change that we have. So at max, 3 channels. Now, could there be more? Maybe one didn't open and there was a 4th one, but it never opened at the same time. But most likely, the max you had in here was 3, right, because you only got 3 that opened when you gave these steps. So this gives you the idea of working out the density of ion channels, because you could patch along the membrane, right? You could find out, does the cell body have a low density of voltage-gated sodiums? You get down to the axon hillock, and you patch there, and you find out, oh, there's a tremendous number of channels for that patch of membrane. And this is how they worked out the density of the channels on cells before they had the ability of antibodies and labeling techniques. Then when those techniques came around to have antibodies with labels, they could see they got more staining in the axon hillock for the voltage-gated sodium channels than other places on the cell. So again, redundancy in techniques, you know, in ways to do things to get to the same point. All right, so we don't have to memorize sequence of channels. I just want you to have the idea that people now know the sequence, the protein sequence, exact amino acids that are in there for normal channels, and you can actually find out if there's a problem with the channel pathology. Like this part, they now know is an inactivating region for the sodium channel. You take that away on an experimental model, you don't have any voltage-gated sodium channel inactivation. So what do you expect the shape of the action potential to be? Kind of an open response question. What would happen then? If we had an experimental design, we took away that sequence where it couldn't make the voltage-gated inactivation, what might we anticipate? We open up. Is it going to be narrower? Is it going to be wider? Maybe wider, right? But it's still going to open up the voltage-gated potassium channels, maybe even higher, right? Because it didn't inactivate. So you can make understand the background, and then you can make predictions. The beauty of science. Okay, this is just extra stuff that we've already talked about. You do this in the lab, so it's a pretty neat experiment in the lab. When you do those experiments, let's go back to that figure right here that we've talked about before. Remember, it deviates from the Nernst equation, the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz, because at low external potassium concentrations, there's a sodium that can go through the potassium channels, right? So this is why it deviates from that. But this is really powerful. What's the slope of this curve when you have the semi-log plot, you know, on the bottom of semi-log? The slope of that is that value that we've talked about, that RT over ZF, converting the log, ln, or whatever you have, right, depending on how you did this, because that slope could be the 58 or the 61, depending on the temperature that you use. So that's the slope of these curves. Okay? All right. Let's see. So in this case, that slope is actually 58 on here because y equals mx, right? Okay. So that's kind of interesting. All right. So that's that chapter. And people ask, you know, what chapter are we on? Where are we? And all this good stuff. Well, we're following this textbook chapter and chapter pretty much, and we'll tell you, you know, where we are. So also, if you have the book or some book, usually at the back of books, there's some review questions for that chapter. I would suggest looking through there and kind of seeing if you understand the content. You can go online and you can do a Google search and say, you know, online exams, physiology, neurophys, or, you know, homeostasis. Usually you're going to get things from Australia or New Zealand or somewhere, and you're going to have the same kind of questions. But it's kind of fun to go through there and test yourself, right? In all your spare time. I know you got so much spare time. I'm joking, okay. Sorry. So it's really quite neat because it gives you the confidence when you can answer those questions. You know, don't pick a question that you haven't heard of at all, right? That doesn't make sense. But it's something that you've gone over, then you should be able to answer some of those questions. So let's understand some other electrical properties of cells and their general properties. Why is it, you know, an action potential initiated in your spinal cord for that motor neuron to get down to the fingertip. What would happen if we took a wire in this room and we had a wire over here and we ran to the back of the room and we put a little DC battery over here, maybe, you know, plus 6 volts, for example, and we had a, you know, a, like to complete the circuit, would you get a 6 volts at the other end? Did you ever do this in physics? Fun experiments in physics? Physics is boring. You could make it so exciting. They don't make it exciting. So many things we could do in physics, right? So many cool things. But most likely, it's not going to be 6 volts at the other end. Why is it not going to be 6 volts at the other end? Because it's lost the current as we've gone along, right? We've lost it. It's called cable properties. And so you don't get that. And you wonder, why is it that we have booster stations, right, and electrical wires across from the power station to your house, for example? Another good example of this, the old-time movies, where you see the red phone in Moscow and the other red phone in Washington, D.C., right? And they would call each other like something's happening. That old transatlantic cable is still on the ground. And it's interesting, last year it was that the U.S. got a little nervous because the Russian trawlers, the submarine, was going along the transatlantic cable. They were wondering, why are they going along the transatlantic cable? Because that's a connection to Europe. It's another way to connect to Europe. And they keep it there instead of the satellites. If the satellites go down, you have still a direct communication. So the transatlantic cable is still down under on the ground. And I think they put down fiber optics as well. But the original one, which they actually put down with wires, it couldn't go from the U.S. over to Europe or to Moscow's red phone with just giving the current at D.C., for example. So what they did is they built pump, you know, these little booster stations all along. So how far away do you want to make these booster stations? Well, you got to understand the cable properties. So it's really kind of interesting that this has happened, and then you wonder, you know, is that transatlantic cable important or not? And maybe if the fiber optics, they don't have to have that booster station so much. But electrical flow, they do, because you lose the potential as you go along. So this gives you the example of this. Now, what's confusing here is that sometimes people think this is the whole axon. This is not the whole axon. This is one side. Let's take the squid axon. And if you drew a circle up here, like a circle, or you redrew this side over here somewhere, then it's like the whole axon. So this is just one side of the axon. This is just one side of the membrane. And this is the inside of the axon. And this is across the bilipid membrane. Now, what did we say across the bilipid membrane? You have leak channels, right? And if they're closed, you've got a high resistance. If they're open, less resistance, right? Because current can go through. But these leak channels are generally open, right? So this is where it gets confusing. Think of leak versus voltage gated. Right now we're talking about leak channels, okay? Leak channels. And what's down the axon? Cytoplasm, okay? Cytoplasm. And so if we gave a current injection at this point right here, and we measured at different lengths along that axon, we would see the voltage drop in amplitude, okay? And why is it dropping in amplitude? Because we got leak channels, right? And the current is leaking. Plus, we got resistance as we go down the internal of the axon, right? We got some resistance. So it's going to drop. It drops. The change is dropping. Now, how to use this in terms that you could explain this to anybody around the world? Well, they use a measurement technique. It's called lambda. Lambda is the length constant. So lambda, the length constant right here, is when that potential drops 63% of the initial value. So there's only 37% left, okay? So you could explain this to somebody on the beach when you're taking spring break, and they had a physiology course, and they're from Guatemala, and you can tell them about lambda, that you've measured this in the lab, and they will understand what you're talking about, because they will have had lambda too. So the idea is this is an international way to understand how membranes function. Okay, so why is it 63%? Anybody remember your algebra way back when? What's 1 over E minus 1? Okay, so you can put that on your calculator. I don't want you to have to work through it. But generally, this is why it is. It's the exponential decrease of this potential. All right, so if you did that, you would find You can put that on your calculator, and you'll have some fun math problem to work out. But we won't give you that kind of problem to work in the lab, or the exam. Basically, to understand this concept, that at 63% of the drop of the initial voltage is lambda. So now we know that if that was 100, and this was 37, that would be the length of lambda, right? It's not that if this was 63 up here, right, and that it dropped 37 millivolts or whatever it was. Let's say this is 100 millivolts, and this is 63 millivolts, and that's 37 millivolts. Where's lambda? It's not the drop of 37. It's the drop of 63. So where now is that 37 millivolts? That would be the length of lambda. So you can measure this on preparations. All right. So this is important, right? Because if your potential dropped, you need enough voltage to open up the voltage-gated calcium channels in the nerve terminal so you can have transmitter release. But fortunately, our motor neurons rejuvenate action potentials as it goes down the axon, and we'll talk about that. Okay. So the idea is that, you know, you travel down the axon and you can lose this potential. All right. We are fortunate in our axons that we have this myelin wrapping, and we have these nodes of Ranvier, and at these nodes of Ranvier, where it was described, there are voltage-gated sodium channels there. So as the action potential decrements about maybe a millivolt from one node to the next node, all of a sudden it's going to hit another patch of voltage-gated sodium channels, and boom, it's going to make another action potential. Okay? And then that can travel. So you really don't lose your action potential going down too much on cable properties because you've rejuvenated as you go along. What about some invertebrate preparations? They don't have this rejuvenation going on. So you might not see a same size action potential where it was initiated at the nerve terminal, for example, because they don't rejuvenate all the time as it goes down the axon. So would you expect real long axons in that preparation? Probably not, right? Shorter preps. So that's kind of interesting. Or maybe such a big action potential that by the time it gets to the nerve terminal, it's still way above threshold of opening up the voltage-gated calcium channels to allow transmitter release. So this is kind of neat to think about. What's the longest axon in the world, do you think? Longest axon in the world. What's the longest animal in the world? Is it a giraffe, hippopotamus, a whale, blue whale or sperm whale? I forget which one. Was it blue whale that's longest, I think? Think of the motor neuron in the cell, in the spinal cord, going all the way down to the, what is that called down there? The flukes, right? Going all the way down there to try to move that down there. Or maybe the sensory endings down there, traveling all the way up to the dorsal root ganglion and then into the, you know, spinal cord of that animal. That axon is meters long, right? Wow. It probably rejuvenates as it goes along, right? It's really quite neat. Otherwise, it'd be too much of a decrement. But then you think, where are the proteins made? Cell body, right? And they got to, you know, all these proteins, we talked about turnover. We'll just get so much turnover. Think of that transport. Long ways, right? Isn't that just amazing? There's so many amazing things out there, you just wonder. Why do we sleep? Okay, so if we take a nerve, like out of your leg, a sciatic nerve, and this is what you're going to maybe do with your frog, compound action potential, and you put an electrode at one end, and you stimulate it, and you record at the other end, what do you get? Remember, it's not a single axon. This is where it gets confusing, okay? This is the confusing part. This is what's called a compound action potential. It's the composite of all the neurons in that nerve. And when you do that, you see something like this. You see this signal that comes very quickly, and then you see another bump, and then you see another bump, and you might even see another one way down there. You think, what on earth is this about, right? And different nerves are going to show different kinds of traces like this. This is a compound action potential where some of them conduct really fast, and some of them conduct a little slower, and some of them really slow, okay? So a majority of them, in this case, are firing relatively quick. But if you look at, if you could dissect out that nerve and look at each one of the axons in there, some of them are firing right here and giving rise to this potential. Some others right here, And then a few more of them have that same conduction velocity where they're giving rise to here. But a lot of them, many of them, let's say 100 here, are all firing at the and have the same conduction velocity, and that's why that amplitude. And now we only have like 75 and 50 and 25 and 10. And then another group starts to have a different conduction velocity, a few more, and then it drops down. So you get this range of conduction velocities in those axons, and when you see that, you get something like this. Now, if this nerve had slower conducting axons and fewer of these, this would be smaller and this would be bigger, right? So it shows you the makeup of that nerve and the different conduction velocities of those neurons in that nerve bundle. Okay, and people have made tables like this. These tables are relative. It depends on the animal. But in general, look at these conduction velocities. These are pretty quick. And this is a frog, one that you're going to be working with, like a sciatic nerve. And, of course, it depends on the temperature. So here you have these A alphas. They have a pretty good conduction velocity, 42 meters per second. 42 meters per second, right? Your alpha motor neurons, alpha, A alpha, are about, in your leg, for example, in your sciatic nerve, at that body temperature, it's about 120 meters a second. 120 meters a second. You know, that's pretty fast, right? So it's really fun when we do outreaching with the school kids. We have them run across the room, say, if you can run as fast as an action potential, you know. Of course, they have to think about it, but it's, you know, they don't even take a step, and it's already at the end of the room. All right? And so it's kind of interesting. And then A beta, A gamma, B, and these are called unmyelinated. Basically, it's not totally unmyelinated, but maybe just one wrapping around it, right? You don't really have negative neurons, but so there's probably some wrapping. But generally, we refer to these as unmyelinated. These are C fibers. These are your pain fibers. So if you burned your skin, for example, match on there and you burned it, you're probably activating these C fibers, and they're relatively slow. Now, you have fast pain ones, too, that tell you, hey, that's, you know, ouch. And you would raise your leg up or something. All right? So what's the point here? The axon diameter. If you have bigger axons, you get faster conduction velocity. Lower resistance is the idea. All right? Lower resistance. So how to understand these conduction velocities in another example. So this guy, Hartline, Dan Hartline, really cool. His dad got a Nobel Prize in vision in limulus and horseshoe crabs at Woods Hole. The son, probably all this pressure on him, he actually continued to work in neurobiology. He's at Hawaii. And he noticed this little copepod, a little invertebrate, very small little invertebrate, that was floating around by the islands in Hawaii. And he took those, and if you touched them, they could move really fast. He said, wow, they move so fast. You touch them at the end, and boy, they could move really quick. So we want to understand how they can have that response so fast. Now, what do we know about what we talked about, different types of synapses a little bit? We talked about gap junctions, right? We talked about releasing transmitters. So maybe there was a gap junction, he thought, in that connection. Maybe from the sensory neuron to a motor neuron. Maybe it didn't even go through an inner neuron. Maybe it just went from sensory neuron to a motor neuron. Maybe there was a gap junction there, so the electrical input would go really fast. So he was wondering about this. So he dissected MOFIN and looked at it, and he found that these copepods were really quite interesting, that they had large axons. Large axon, right? Fast conduction. But a little animal with a large axon. Kind of like a squid, right? So the squid had large axons. And that's why its conduction velocity is relatively quick. Depends on the temperature. All right? So that was pretty neat. And then it had a synapse and then went to motor neurons. And then he looked at, you know, comparative biologists, neurobiologists. Then he looked at some other copepods that were like in the South Pacific, down by Australia, New Zealand area. And he thought, well, those are pretty fast too, but they're different species. They probably have the same thing. Just set them open, he touches them, and they move really fast. No, the axons were super small. Whoa, what's going on? But there was something else. When he did the cross-sections, he found out there was many wrappings around them. So they were like myelinated. Not really myelin, the same protein, but the same properties. So that myelination allowed it to go very fast. Why is that? So if we go back to... where was it? If we go back to these principles, and I guess right here, kind of, how is the myelination help? The general idea. All right, let's do this. Let's put this thing on this overhead thing. I think it'll work this way. Yes, it should be recording an echo too. All right, so if we take this axon and we have little negative charges here, right, because the inside of the cell is generally negative that we've talked about, and it's right across the bilipid membrane. Okay, so we give this current that comes in here, let's say it's a sodium current. What does this have to do as it goes along this membrane? It has to neutralize this charge. It has to neutralize this charge. So now this turns to positive, and what's going to happen when this turns to positive? What's going to happen to the positive on the other side? It's going to be repelled, right? So now this positive moves away, and it becomes negative. And you can see this is going to keep happening as we go along the cell. But this is that capacitance that we've been talking about before, the capacitance that can build across the membrane, right, generally. Well, what if we take those two metal plates, like if we put negative current on one side, it's going to track the positive over here. What if we take those two plates and we separate them apart? They're not going to have the influence so much on each other, right? So this is the general idea. It's a little bit more to it, but it's a general idea. So now if we have wrappings around here, and we have these wrappings around here, the myelin, what have we done? We've taken away this capacitance charge, basically, if you want to think about it, across these regions of the membrane. All right, so now we don't have any capacitance charge there. So what's going to happen to the electrical potential? It's going to basically jump from node to node to node. And it can travel faster. That's the general idea, okay, with the myelination. So this is called saltatory conduction, jumping. Saltatory conduction. So the idea with myelination, just the general point, is that it decreases that capacitance, that it doesn't have to neutralize to speed up the conduction velocity. So this is why myelinated, wherever that thing was, myelinated, does it work? Oh, I have to go back here. Myelinated neurons go really fast. Okay, so that idea. So myelinated fibers, very fast, and if they're large, they're even going to go faster. And if they're smaller, they're going to take longer time. Now, the other point about the size. So here's a way to remember this. Fire hose, garden hose, right? Fire hose, you can get a lot of water through it, right? It's going to flow really quick. Garden hose, what's going to happen there? You've got a lot of resistance. You're not going to get as much water through there, right? So now you can remember this. You got it in your brain forever. Garden hose, fire hose. You're not going to miss this on any standardized exams. What's another example that we have to think about with this membrane and membrane resistance that we're going to talk about drop in your potential, like what we just talked about with lambda, for example. Let's take the garden hose. We don't have any holes in it. And what's the water going to be like over there? If we open up the faucet over here, we're going to get some water there. Maybe, you know, there's some resistance along there, right? But we're going to get water to come out the end. Well, we have high resistance along that garden hose. Now, what if you're so upset and you get your exam back that you take your ice pick and you stab that garden hose with a lot of holes in it, right? And you make a soaker hose out of it. What's going to happen? You open up that faucet. What's going to happen to the water pressure down at the other end and the amount of water that's going to come out? It's going to squirt out all the way around, right? So think of a lot of leak channels in that membrane. What's going to happen to the potential as you get down to the end? It's going to be a lot smaller. So if you have more leak channels, what's your lambda going to be? Short, right? Because you're going to decrement a lot quicker. All right, so you can put these concepts into, you know, some kind of analogy, and maybe it'll help you figure it out. All right, so something else that we were going to do. Oh, yeah, before I forget. Good. So we've talked about lambda. So remember lambda, okay? Length constant. It's a length, sorry. Okay, yep, there we go. Lambda. What was the other factor that we wanted to remember? And I don't want you to, your textbook has a formula for lambda. Don't try to memorize that formula because it really depends on the axon. It's generalized, but they actually have different lambda formulas for large axons and different formulas for smaller axons. But the general idea, what's the principle with lambda, what makes up that length, leak, right, resistance. So just that you understand those concepts, that would be really good. The other term that we wanted to remember, we mentioned it earlier, but we probably all forgot about it, was tau, right? Do you remember what tau was? What was tau? Oh my gosh, that was so long ago. We purged it all. Yes. That is a protein. There are tau proteins. Very good. But in this case, for biophysical properties of the membrane. But you're right. These taus build up and they can cause problems with Alzheimer's and things like this. But tau, in this case, the electrical potential of the cell. So tau is actually the time constant. We talked about length here. Length. And this one is time. Okay? So now we're going to look at something else. We're going to inject a current into the cell, right? We inject a current, I, and we're going to measure the membrane potential, V, M. And we see something like this. It goes up, and it comes down, right? Why doesn't it have a square wave initially? Why doesn't it go up like a square wave? Remember this? Why did it not go up as a square wave? Let's expand this a little bit. It might be easier. Okay. Why is it gradual like that? Your charge has to build up. Your capacitance current builds up quickly, right? And then that you don't have the charge building up anymore, so there's no more capacitive current. But then the membrane resistance, we're building up the potential through that membrane. So it's really the resistance of the membrane. These are passive properties we're talking about. So the resistance and the capacitance. Tau is equal to R times C. R of the membrane, membrane resistance, and capacitance of the membrane. They were two initials, right? Okay. In case you figured that one out. Okay, so R times C is tau. It's membrane resistance and capacitance of the membrane. All right. How do we determine that? Let's just do an example. Let's say we injected some current, and the voltage, this might be the easiest way to think of it, went to 100 millivolts. Okay, went up to 100 millivolts. Tau is the time it takes to get to 63% of the max that we have here. So let's say this is the time it took. That's tau. And that is, let's say this is 63 millivolts now. Okay? So now we have rise tau. So this is considered tau rise. What about when we turned off the current? This right here drops, right? Now, on a resistors and capacitors on a little circuit that you might make in a physics class, it's going to be equal. But in biological membranes, it's not always equal because what happened? You might have opened up other channels and there's some differences. So when you read textbooks, sometimes they're going to tell you that the tau for rise and the tau for decay. And it's just because there's some differences in the membrane that might happen when you depolarize. But basically, what's the decay tau here? So you're not confused on exams because we test you on the rise and the decay. It's going to be the decay of 63% from the 100. So what's left here? 37 millivolts. All right? So the idea is it's always a change of 63. Again, 1 over E minus 1, right? Okay, so why is this important? Why should we care about this? Well, we're going to care about this because when we talk about synaptic transmission. Okay, here's my Medusa drawing. So this is a neuron in your spinal cord. And this is a synaptic response right here. We're going to release transmitter here, and we're going to depolarize this cell, this little dendrite, sensory ending. And we have a little graded response here, okay? And you let's say you could measure inside with an intracellular electrode, and you get this little graded response. And that little graded response is going to travel along the cell soma. And let's say this is the site of spike initiation. This is where there's a high density of voltage-gated sodium channels, so you can generate an action potential, all right? Well, what's going to happen to that potential as it goes along this cell? What's going to happen to it? Is it going to get bigger or smaller? Smaller, smaller, because of lambda, right? It's got leak channels across here. Plus, what happened? That dendrite, very small dendrite, all of a sudden hit this big soma. What happened to the side, the membrane surface area? It went from a small surface area to all of a sudden this big surface area. Spread out the electrical gradient all over that big surface, so it's even going to decrement even more. So when it gets in here, it's very small. So by the time it gets to the voltage-gated sodium channels, what's going to happen? It's so small, it might be below threshold. Let's say this is threshold. So it doesn't generate an action potential. Yikes. Doesn't generate an action potential. But what if we had two pulses really fast together? We had two signals that gave transmission and transmission. And now, what happens to this shape here? Let's do this one. It gave two pulses. This one went up, and let's say the next one took a long time. Well, this is still going to just generate two small events, right? But what if the second event came really quickly? What if the second event was on top of the other one? Remember, this is chemical transmission that just opens up some channels that causes sodium to go in and depolarize the membrane. Well, now that amplitude's higher, right? So by the time it gets down here, we might have something now like this. But it didn't quite get there. But what about the third one, right? If you gave three of them together. Now, that might be high enough that all of a sudden it gets to a threshold and boom, you got the action potential. You get the idea? Okay. So what is this called? This is called temporal summation. Test question. Perk up. Get your ears going. Temporal summation. Temporal summation. Because it's temporally summating. Now, what if we have signals on this dendrite and we have signals over here on the other dendrite? And this one's graded. And we only had one graded response over here. Well, they're going to hit the cell body, and what's going to happen? If they're same time or very close to it, they could add, right? Oh, sorry, what happened? Oh, yep, thanks. Sorry. So you could have a graded response here and a graded response here, hits the cell body, they could add, right? So the same idea. And now when that comes down here, maybe it's above threshold and fires an action potential. This is called spatial summation. Spatial summation, okay? So spatial, different locations, versus temporal, the same spot. How does this fit with tau that we just talked about? What if tau was very short? If tau was very short and it came back quickly, what would happen when you get the next pulse? You just get the same stuff again, right? If tau was long time constant, and this was longer, more likely you're going to get a greater summation, right? Either temporal or spatial. So now you understand why tau is important, okay? So when you get the open response question, why is tau important? Is that it can build on the potentials such that it could reach threshold, and if you gave an example like this, we really know that you understand it, right? So this is important for spatial and temporal summation to then maybe get above the threshold, opening up voltage-gated sodium channels so you can generate an action potential. This is how your brain works. This is how your motor neurons work in your spinal cord, right? You get signals coming at the same time to then generate that. Or you get repetitive signals that can tell you you got to activate that motor neuron. So this is how synaptic communication is going on in your brain and thinking and all that good stuff. Spatial and temporal summation. All right. Good stuff. Cool stuff. All right, so we talked about tau, we talked about lambda, we talked about size of axons, we talked about all those nice principles. And we're going to talk a little bit about synaptic transmission. So gap junctions. These are these little gap junctions that you see between cells that can travel really fast, like in your heart, or maybe in some spots of our brain we have some gap junctions, but it's not common in our brain. You see these more in invertebrates. Okay, that allows signals to travel very quickly across from one neuron to the other, and small ions like sodium, potassium, but not large proteins, right? And you can give a current here, and you can see the potential here, and you can see the potential over here. Sometimes, it's very odd, people are still studying this, these gap junctions can allow current to go better one direction than the other, and it's still not completely understood how that happens. Isn't that wild? It's not still really well understood. But there's something different about the way the proteins are in here. The idea is that this is for fast communication between two cells. Okay, so electrical synapses, they can look at that, you can measure in one and the other, and you see, you know, it goes through the gap junctions. Now, let's think about synaptic transmission that's the common that you've heard about before, vesicular fusion events. So, this is a little bit schematic in the sense of this channels, but you get an action potential comes down, sodium, potassium that we talked about, but in the presynaptic nerve terminal, you have voltage-gated calcium channels. Calcium comes in and causes those little spheres, vesicles, to fuse to the membrane, release their transmitter across the synaptic cleft, bind to receptors like that, and then you get whatever those receptors are, give rise to the signal. Okay, and then those vesicles recycle. The main take home here is that you have voltage-gated calcium channels, calcium comes in, that calcium is key for those vesicles to fuse. Okay, and depending on the receptor, those receptors might be, this is the key, the receptors might be an ion channel themselves, like your nicotinic receptors in your muscle, or they might be what's called metabotropic receptors. They are not ion channels. They work through a second messenger cascade and then could open or close a channel. So ionotropic is a channel itself. Receptor transmitter binds to it, it opens up, it's an ion channel. Metabotropic, receptor binds to it, it does not open, it's a protein that then triggers a second messenger in the cell and then can work on channels. That's ionotropic. I just want to show you, this is not, I'll put it up on your Google thing or whatever, your class. This is an EM micrograph of one of your favorite preparations, crayfish neuromuscular junction. Look at those nice vesicles. Look at the synapse. This is postsynaptic muscle. This is the presynaptic motor nerve terminal. And we'll talk a little bit about vesicles and the proteins. They're really important. Okay? Great.